is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and tonight's story is rather long, so I'm going to start right away. It's called Little Abu, the Boy Who Knew Too Much by Norma DeHart. So, hope you're ready. Long, long ago, in the lush tropical country of Guyana, land of many waters, there was a boy named Abu. Abu lived on an island in Essequibo River in the county of Essequibo. Hundreds of islands are clustered along the river, especially at the mouth, but many of these lands are uninhabitable. However, Abu lived on one of the largest, called a lagoon, situated where the swift flowing river current meets the Atlantic Ocean. Abu's parents had been brought to the island as slaves from Africa, but like many others, they remained on the island when they were freed. After emancipation, most of the people on the island purchased large plots of land from plantation owners and stayed on the island, working as farmers in their own right. Their main crops of sugarcane, rice, and coconuts, from which oil was made, were chiefly for export, while vegetables and ground provisions were grown for domestic use. Cattle farmers sold cattle, milk, meat, and hides to the region around, as far as the city of Georgetown. Abu's parents had purchased large plots of land. However, bit by bit, his father leased or sold most of the land and kept only the lot on which the house was built. He also kept a few head of cattle. Old Abu was not interested in farming. He had learned the secret nature and effects of certain plants, berries, and roots. This knowledge, which he brought from Africa, deepened with the abundance and rich variety of tropical shrubs, vines, berries, and flowering plants. When people had headache, fever, couldn't eat or sleep, and felt depressed, if they were bitten by venomous snakes or insects, scratched by poisonous plants, he administered bush medicines, potions, brews, and teas. In this manner, he alleviated pain and stress, eliminated poisons from the body, and restored his clients to health. Consequently, people traveled for miles from the farthest corner of the island and the far reaches of the coastlands to pay old Abu a visit and tell him their problems. In those days, there were no doctors to look after the slaves or indentured servants. Old Abu, therefore, provided an important service necessary for the survival of the community. Without this service, many people would have died for lack of care, and the population of the island would have been decimated. Therefore, as natural as day is to night, tropical flora is to fauna, old Abu was the center to the well-being of the people in the region around. Even as a young boy, little Abu began to learn these secrets from his father. He was not interested in farming, as were the boys in the village. But when the village boys went with their parents and relatives down to the back dam to work on their farms, little Abu went and worked alongside them. If anyone was slashed by razor grass or a sharp tool, bitten by poisonous snakes or insects, or injured by cantankerous cattle, little Abu was as resourceful as his father. He treated the wound with crushed leaves, berries, and moss, then bound it securely with special leaves and vines. The boys in the village were in awe of little Abu. They had the greatest respect for him. During the planting and harvesting season, children did not attend school. Every child went down to the back dam. Those who were capable worked side by side with parents until seedlings were sown or the harvest reaped. It was not unusual for neighbors to pitch in and help each other until the work was done. Even though little Abu's parents did not farm on a large scale, little Abu accompanied his friends and their parents down to the back. Early in the morning, when it was still pitch dark, the boys would stop near little Abu's house on their way to call him with a prearranged signal. Hoot, 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 or kiss, 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 kadee. Three times they would utter the throaty cry of the owl or the clear trilling sound of the kiskadee. Then they would move on slowly down the road, country road, to wait. In nothing more than a few minutes, little Abu would join them, shouldering a rice bag like the other boys. Every boy enjoyed being in the back dam because it wasn't all hard work. The outdoors provided lots of interest and fun. Just before the sun was right overhead, everyone stopped for a meal and a rest. This was the cue the boys were awaiting. The ocean surrounding the island, the inlets and streams, even the waters of the rice or sugarcane fields were teeming with fish. With bare hands, small baskets or nets, the boys would catch and toss fish to each other, returning to the waters the ones that weren't good enough or the right type. This was exciting sport. On the other hand, some boys preferred the taste of fowl, goose, turkey, or pheasant, which roamed wild and in great flocks, abundant on the island. With great care, the boys would set about making snares to entrap their prey, but it was more thrilling to separate a few birds from the wily flock. The plan was to surround the birds, infantry style, run them down in one direction, then back again until the birds retired. Then the boys closed in on the exhausted prey. While returning from these pursuits, a few boys would spread out to gather fruit. They might collect fruit from their own trees or carry out a raid on their neighbors, depending on which looked better. In those days, no one minded as long as trees weren't damaged or destroyed. They chose from the best mangoes, guavas, pineapples, oranges, tangerines, pawpaws, dunks, gynips, psyllium, golden, star, custard, and monkey apples, the last along with the luscious purple jamuns that grew wild on the island. They picked whatever took their fancy. But the real contest began when they decided to pick water coconuts. After suitable trees were selected, they raced to see who would be the first to shinny up the trees with bare hands. Sometimes each boy mounted the long, straight, barrel-like trunk carrying a short, sharp-pointed prod or cutlass between the teeth. Many boys performed this difficult task with great ease and flourish. But it was not unusual for a boy to lose his grasp, fall, and become seriously injured. When fruit was collected from the ground or picked off trees, the boys were very cautious. Care was taken to use long, pliant sticks to prod the ground around the fruit in order to drive away small, poisonous snakes hidden between leaves and fruit. Leaves and branches of trees provide a camouflage for vipers and stinging insects. No boy ventured anywhere without a stick for protection. These boys worked hard on the land, but found ways to make life interesting while the land yielded its bounty. Many stories were exchanged, repeated, and handed down from one generation to the other as a result of these experiences and escapades. Sometimes a few did not have happy endings. Little Abu worked hard alongside his friends, but he was more interested in the animals, insects, and plants around him. Sometimes he would lie stretched out on the grassy dam or under a coconut tree, noticeably absorbed as he lay still, listening, hand cupped to his ear. No one teased or laughed at him. His friends were aware of the unique attraction between Little Abu and the creatures around him. As he listened to the chirping of the cricket and the chirr-chirr of the grasshopper a long distance away, he could tell whether the sound was made by a male or a female. He had pointed out and explained these differences to his friends over and over. While they strained their ears to listen without success, they never disputed his knowledge. When Little Abu said it was so, that was enough for them. Nevertheless, the boys were terrified when a passing scorpion, centipede, or the vicious and feared red-biting ants crawled across Little Abu's bare arm, body, or neck, leaving no marks or stings. Once a boy named Noah hit a huge warty toad, which was sunning itself on the dam with his stick. All the boys laughed, except Little Abu. "You fool," he growled, flying into a rage, hitting the transgressor with his stick. He sulked for the rest of the day, remaining far away from the group, even though he had taken the toad back to the trench and they had seen it swim away. After that incident, his friends were careful not to hit a frog, toad, or any creature while he was around. They were frightened of Little Abu's anger. However, his companions were spellbound when he mimicked the mating call and song of every bird on the island. He knew each bird's identity from its call. It was not uncommon for a thrush or kiskadee, attracted by his call, to sit on his outstretched arm, trilling and singing as if its chest would burst. Many birds came to his call, and the boys never ceased to be amazed at these performances. As the afternoon sun started to set, large flocks of showy macaws, parrots, and parakeets congregated. Moving from tree to tree, they set up a chattering and squalling. Then upwards they would fly again, colorful in the dazzling light, joined by flocks of herons, mallards, seagulls, and cranes that nestled on the seashore. They fluttered, picturesque against the sky-blue canvas, plumes bathed in the golden rays of sunset. Together the birds filled the air with a warlike chattering, screeching, screaming, chirping, churring. Swirling forward, then backward, then forward again, they would race westward home. One late afternoon, when the birds were at their loudest, everyone was preparing to leave. In the gathering twilight, the 6 o'clock bee kept up a tiresome buzzing, and the howling monkeys, invisible to the eye, smote the air with their doleful, impulsive call, without a break or pause. The boys had already mustered the herds together and were chasing the obedient cattle homeward. Each boy was well aware his cows would instinctively stop off and, like homing pigeons, enter their own yards. But the day was far from over. Stealthily, the boys advanced towards the seashore. They were exceptionally quiet, knowing the snapping sound of breaking twigs, the thud-thud of footsteps, would scare away the prizes. Their faces were a study in pure delight as giant blue crabs, following the leader in soldier-like files, marched entranced towards the ocean and into the ready and waiting rice bags. Satisfied, the companions moved off without the slightest sound. There was a chance they might discover a turtle or two burying in the sand. With a quick flip, the unsuspecting creatures were turned over on their backs. Then hurriedly but carefully, the boys searched for eggs in the sand. "Listen! What was that unearthly hissing?" With quick, light steps, the friends rushed over to help two of their companions, who caught a couple of iguanas, hissing and struggling to get free. The creatures thrashed about wildly, using their tails as whipcords and baring sharp, ugly teeth. But with dexterity, the boys tied the tails securely to the iguanas' scaly backs, while the captors grinned in triumph. These catches, highly esteemed, were sought after as delicacies. But little Abu had not joined the high-spirited group. Like the blue crab, he marched as though entranced over the shifting sand towards the Atlantic Ocean. With ears cocked, body alert, he appeared to be listening. He listened to the dreary, haunting echoes of the wind as it rose and fell, swelling the tide into giant waves, crashing, lashing against each other, furiously rolling into one, only to be spent gradually on the seashore. The boy stared at little Abu, then from one to the other, speechless, helpless, scared. Little Abu was now standing in the water, knee-deep in the slowly sinking sand, trance-like, muttering. His mutterings grew louder and clearer as he repeated over and over in sing-song words his friends could not recognize. Then little Abu screamed, and immediately the spell he was under seemed to be broken, but only for a moment, as he stumbled out of the water towards them, reeling from side to side. "You hear?" he cried out. It was more a statement than a question. For a fleeting moment he gazed at his companions, searching their faces, looking into each one's eyes, expectant, as if they could comprehend or define the significance of his sudden penetration. He stood before them, breathless, chest heaving, then charged past in the direction of home. The boys stared after little Abu, stupefied, eyeing each other. They had seen his brown face strained with distress, his dark eyes bright with a knowledge that confused them. As he spoke, they too had leaned forward, listening, but no one responded. They dared not reveal their own thoughts. All they heard was the sighing of the wind. They stood there, hesitating, looking bleak and bewildered, eyes following little Abu, who had already become a trail of dust in the darkness. That was the last afternoon Little Abu and his companion spent together as boys. It was a time they would remember for the rest of their lives because of the things they did together and the unusual event that brought their relationship to a dramatic, if not abrupt, ending. Later that evening, the news spread around the village. Old Abu was dying. The boys could not explain why Little Abu's absence created such a void in their daily activities. He had little interest in field work. He was eternally drawn to the plants and animals, spending most of his time observing them. Yet as the boys passed Little Abu's house the very next morning, they gave the signal, but didn't wait for him down the road. As they ambled along, they gazed back every now and then, wistful, though deep in their hearts they knew he would never join them again. Death hung over the Abu's household for a little more than a week. As was customary, villagers knocked on the Abu's door during this time, but were never successful in seeing any one of the family. No one was admitted. No one ever left the house, and no fire was lit for days in the kitchen, which stood apart from the house. The villagers started to whisper among themselves. They claimed they recognized Little Abu's mother's muted, mournful wailings and Little Abu's voice above the weakened chants of his father. At times, they gossiped about the eerie and mysterious silences inside the house. A shadow of suspicion and tension hung over the village. But curiosity whetted the villagers' appetites for more information, so they continued to knock at the Abu's. They left gifts of food and fresh fruit. There was nothing else they could do, so they waited. Then one morning, a villager passed by and saw the flag. Soon it was all over the island. Old Abu was dead. This time, when the villagers called on the Abus, they were welcomed inside and allowed to share in the family's grief. Sometime afterwards, the people realized Abu was no longer a boy, though he was no more than 15 years old at the time. Abu is now head of our family. He will provide for us, Abu's mother, plump and half-smiling, announced pleasantly to a villager who called. This announcement troubled the villagers. They had kept a respectful distance after the funeral while still sharing their bounty of fruit and fish. But is how they going to make out at all? The poor boy is too young. Ow, ow. It's not only that, man. You ain't seen the boy. He's a dreamer. They whispered, scoffing at the idea among themselves. These snatches of conversation took place among neighbors whenever Mrs. Abu appeared in the yard, minding the stock or tending the kitchen garden. Then one day, Mrs. Abu went to the village shop a few miles away. She purchased a large quantity of groceries, cotton fabrics, and familiar household items for which she paid with a handsome sovereign. The shopkeeper was amazed. The gold piece overwhelmed him. He nodded his head as he considered the situation. Mrs. Abu was not a regular customer, that was true. She was one of a breed of quiet, thrifty women. Then old Abu must have had quite a mint tucked away. Of course. Indeed, it had slipped his memory. Old Abu made a good trade from his bush medicine and chants. Why, at one time or another, many of the villagers, not excluding himself, had cause to visit old Abu. The old man never took money but accepted gifts, a calf, a lamb, or a young goat, even a half bag of rice. And he was careful to keep no more than 5 or 6 head of cattle. Cattle always fetched a good price. Real clever, me buddy smart man. The shopkeeper smiled triumphantly while he busied himself helping Mrs. Abu pack her many purchases in a huge basket, set it on her head, and then with characteristic ease and friendliness he saw her off. By nightfall the news had spread like wildfire. The whole island was bubbling with excitement, predicting and calculating the Abu's worth. When the topic was exhausted, the villagers turned to young Abu. They talked, adding new details, giving new dimension to stories about his bewitchment of animals. Of course, during the time he was locked in with his father, they knew exactly what went on and elaborated their views on the subject. The fact that no one was allowed to enter the house while it was reported that the young lads and his father's feeble chantings were heard added more fuel to their imaginations. They recounted the unusual things such a little boy had done, which when they had seen with their own eyes. They babbled, hemmed, hawed, shook with displeasure, appeared shocked, and the village buzzed. Then one day, the boy Noah, who had struck the toad, carried his sick little sister wrapped in a blanket to see his friend Abu. Noah waited in the outer room while Abu's mother went inside to fetch him. Abu appeared, and Noah was amazed at the change in him. Abu was no longer the boy he had known. He was at least a head taller. Reposed, he stood before his friend, magnificent in a long, flowing white robe, hair closely cropped, fingers entwined across his stomach. Abu moved with the same smooth grace which had seemed womanish and unfavorable when they romped together as boys. Noah, so taken aback by the change, forgot for a moment the rigid bundle in his arms. "My friend," Abu greeted them. His voice sounded different too, Noah, yet it stirred strong feelings, reminding him of the not-too-dim past, reflecting confidence, spirit, and humility. "I see you are well, but your little sister, Beatrice?" Abu's words hung in the air, stunning Noah. Abu could not have known her. Even now the little body was well wrapped because of the fever, and her face was covered, save for a little opening for breathing. It was really incredible. Beatrice, one of 15-month-old twins, was difficult to identify. Yet Abu called her name without removing the blanket. Abu unwrapped the covering, then placed the rigid infant down gently on the pallet bed. The child lay scarcely moving. Only the slight heaving of her chest, followed by a weak moan, signaled she was alive. "You must leave her, maybe 2 days," Abu gestured, nodding his head, touching the distended stomach. "My mother and I..." "No, no," gasped Noah in despair, rushing to his sister's bedside. At that moment, Beatrice made a low, whining sound, opening her eyes, which were dark and sunken. "What will I tell my mother?" His voice quavered. He wrung his hands in wild panic. Abu said nothing. He was already soothing the fevered brow with a piece of cotton dipped in calabash of pleasant-smelling liquid. Noah was in a dilemma. There was no one else to help his sister, yet he feared leaving her, a mere infant, with this boy who had developed overnight into the mysterious stranger standing before him. Suddenly it was clear to him what to do. He backed towards the wall. Whatever happened, he would remain in the room with Beatrice. "If you trust me, you must go," Abu spoke softly, but his tone, though compassionate, conveyed a command, startling Noah to his feet as he was about to sit down. He wrung his hands, moaning again and again. However, head bent and without a word, he went through the door, thoroughly perplexed. Mrs. Abu silently closed it behind him. By the end of the day, the news had spread and people gathered outside the Abus, watchful, sullen, and expectant. "But is why they keep the people's child at all? Don't ask me, my girl. That's what I come to find out." "Old Abu never do that. He used to give you good medicine and send you away." "Girl, a time he give me something and I tell you, when I take it, I was sick. But since then, all right." "Is why they doing so long. Is why they keep the people chill for. To carry on with the rigmarole, what else?" Talking loudly, they ridiculed, praised, and blamed the Abus. They gossiped nonstop until someone shouted, "Oh, you better fetch the police," and everything grew suddenly silent. The Abus ignored the disturbance. They continued with what they were doing as if no one was in their front yard. By nightfall, Abu thought half of the village was camped outside his door. He could see the flicker of their bottle lamps through the cracks in the wall, and he had recognized many of his father's visitors who had stayed over on countless occasions. Their children, too, were left quite willingly for his parents to care for. At times he thought the noise would never end. He pondered the sudden opposition, but was indifferent to their protestations. A few more hours and the child would be well. He was not afraid of the police, and besides, they were miles away. Hey, look, the police coming, somebody shouted. It was the afternoon of the second day. The villagers, quiet from their watch since the day before, eyed each other awkwardly and with unease. The policeman came into the yard. Everyone remained quiet, making way for him to get through. But before he could, the door was opened by Mrs. Abu, who appeared with a blanket folded and draped over her left arm, leading Beatrice with the other. "Give her plenty young coconut water," Mrs. Abu said to Beatrice's mother and father, who had instinctively moved forward. She hesitated a moment. "Mama!" Beatrice called cheerfully as she hurried to her mother's outstretched arms. The mother came forward, eyes downcast, caught her, looked up, embarrassed, to the open door, but Mrs. Abu made a graceful nod, then closed it. "Look, the child get better already." The mob pushed forward to get a better look at Beatrice in her mother's arms. "She really looking better. She never looked so sprightly before. She was always sickly looking. The Boos is decent people. Old Abu was good man. I don't know what got into all y'all to send for the police. The young man do a very good job. You all should thank the people," a thoughtful villager said loudly. The mob babbled on without shame. "The police got no right here." That did it. Constable Mariah was exasperated more than he was confused. As he pushed his way back through the crowd and stood aside, mopping his brow, he was the one to give up his lunch hour. He had just finished cooking and left the comfortable shelter of the tiny outpost, walked 5 miles through the broiling midday sun, and for what? He was supposed to question the Abus about the child, the same child who was right before his eyes, unharmed. He looked about to see if he could identify any of the instigators who had crowded into the small outpost, but couldn't recognize any of them. And he wished he had taken down a few names. How he disliked writing long statements. The truth was, he disliked police work more. "Mr. Policeman, drink this water, coconut. It will cool you down." Out of the blue, a woman, head wrapped with a large colorful head tie, lopped off the top of a coconut, chipped a small hole in it, and thrust it at him. "You all get off these people property," he barked with forced authority, and the crowd began shuffling off. Early the next morning, Mrs. Abu went out to milk the cow. She discovered, much to her surprise, a pair of ewes tethered in the yard. She stared at the ungainly creatures for a moment. Then, smiling to herself, she placed them with the other stock and went on with her work. She would tell Abu later, but was certain he already knew about it. After the healing of Beatrice, word about young Abu grew like lush paddy plants. He was openly approved, his authority accepted, and he became highly respected. Consequently, his influence extended to people of diverse persuasions and interests. A few weeks later, a farmer, jealous of his wife, ended her life in a savage manner. The neighbors had already gossiped about his unreasonable attitude and deplored his regular assaults. They had heard her cries against his violent abuse and were outraged, but had kept their distance. On the night in question, her cries were unbearable, and therefore a report was made to the police. Early the next morning, Constable Mariah appeared on the scene to investigate the matter. The husband invited him in, but maintained his wife had left earlier in the morning to catch the first ferry. She had gone to visit her parents on the coastland. Constable Mariah's suspicion was aroused when he noted a baby among a brood of children, all too young to be taken care of by the father. Unsatisfied, the constable questioned the farmer at length, but the man could not explain why his wife had left the baby. Then the constable talked to the neighbors, who agreed the woman would never leave the children. The policeman checked the ferry and, convinced the woman never left the island, returned with a warrant to search the house and grounds. He went over every inch of the farmer's house and yard, but found nothing. However, fearful the man would disappear, Constable Mariah arrested him. Because of the murder investigation and the diggings, the police force on the island was strengthened. They needed a body in order to establish a case against the husband. Also, by this time, the woman's distressed parents reported they had not seen her. The investigation was now in the hands of an inspector from the coastland. Constable Mariah was tired of digging. He argued about the time being wasted and made a suggestion that the body was not anywhere around, hinting they might have to let the man go. Cautiously, he proposed to get young Abu's help. The inspector and the rest of the crew were shocked the constable would venture to make a joke out of the investigation. They turned on him with jibes and taunts. He challenged them with what he had heard about Abu, but they took no notice of him. The search became extensive, spreading to farmlands down into the back in the back dam. The task was impossible, and the crew was exhausted. The inspector threw sideways glances at the men as they mumbled, whispering among themselves, sucking their teeth and yawning unabashed. He was uneasy. He knew what was on their minds, and later that evening went to see Abu in secret. "Tomorrow morning, at 4:30, meet me on the bridge. I'll be waiting." Abu greeted the inspector, who gazed at him speechless. How could Abu know? The inspector hadn't said a word. Next morning, the inspector and his party arrived sometime after 4 to find Abu waiting on the bridge in front of the yard. As they started off, Abu insisted he walk ahead of them. In this manner, they walked. Abu 20 yards or more ahead in long flowing robes, with the hood covering his head and bare feet. Abu led the party straight for the back dam. They walked for miles across farms, trenches, and dams. The inspector checked his watch at intervals. It was still dark, but the men were sweating and tiring. Through rice fields and cane fields, they went on a long and arduous journey. By this time, the inspector was sure it was a wild goose chase. The men puffed and sweated as they tried to keep up with Abu. "What does man take it as all? We working hard all day while he's sitting down in the house. I can't understand why he's flying like that and at 4 a.m. Watch where you're going, man. You nearly tripped me up. Jesus, man, I cannot keep up at all. What the hell is this? Some force driving him, man. You notice too? Look at him, man, like he foot ain't touching the ground. And he ain't even looking back. This ain't natural. Can it be natural? This man ain't human." Baffled by the mysterious figure ahead, the men tramped laboriously behind, fretting and swearing. But Abu never looked back, and he moved like the wind. Suddenly, Abu stopped and would go no farther. Beckoning to the inspector, he pointed, describing a spot ahead on the dam and insisting the men would discover there what they wanted. The inspector rushed forward, keeping the men at a distance while he looked for the clues Abu spoke about. In an instant, he called excitedly to the men and, pointing to a spot, instructed them to dig. Within minutes of digging, there was a chorus of enthusiastic cries. The men had found the body. The search was over. Jubilant, the inspector called loudly, summoning Abu. Getting no response, he hurried forward with expressions of praise. He stared ahead, but Abu was nowhere around. He gazed into the distance. Abu could not have gone far. In excitement, the inspector ran down the dam until he was out of breath, then stopped and took in stretches of the dam as far as the eye could see. Abu had disappeared completely. I hope you enjoyed that story. That was Little Abu, The Boy Who Knew Too Much by Norma DeHart. This is Ms. G bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at KTOO 104.3 Juneau, Alaska. Good night until next time. And I'm bringing you new letters on the air already in progress.